Hi, I'm Alexander. I'm quantum software tech lead at Pascal, and I'm here to talk about a strategy, which is that no one used my software. It's not a laughing matter, very sad. Basically, I'm going to also talk a little bit about the open source ecosystem at the end and sort of some desires in that direction, but basically. So I've been working now 3.5 years building quantum software professionally. First is the startup called Q & Co. We're just doing pure software, which has its own particular requirements, let's say. And then it got merged with Pascal, a hardware company, to make like a big full stack quantum company. And before that, I was working in high performance computing and machine learning. Today at Pascal, I mostly work on the sort of HPC QC integration topic, combining, basically figuring out how to have quantum computers, say, in an HPC center to do like large scale computations, a bit of programming languages, the libraries, and yeah, just analog computing that Dave was just talking about, and of course digital computing as well. How did I end up here? Well, to be honest, I was home alone and I was drinking whiskey. And I was seeing the CFP come out. And at first I read it and I was like, languages, tools, compilation, navigation. I just figured this is just a bit too much for me on a Sunday. And then luckily I saw the off the beaten tracks topics. Lessons learned, insight, fun, visions. Now this is more like it. More Sunday appropriate material. And to be honest, the quantum software job role that was presented in the introductory slides, I think I feel I spend more time making PowerPoints than any of that. So maybe this off the beaten track topic is indeed for for me. I submitted it. It got accepted. I was like, oh, crap. It's easy enough to write a proposal. Then I had to figure out what to say. That was harder. But I started with saying, by just Googling, why no one used my software. Get some inspiration. I hit the jackpot in the first result. It was great. It was actually an article by a company called Lemon Learning. They have a their software company, they make a, let's say, a training tool for enterprise software. So you're a big enterprise, you buy lots of software, you have like your own custom plugins integrations, and they're basically the training for that. I was reading through their list now, and I was like, this resonates with me. This is exactly the feeling I have also in quantum software. It turns out there's nothing special about it. Your employees have too many software tools. We do have a lot of SDKs in quantum, I'm afraid. There's no added value of them. Yes, this is arguably a problem. Practical software training and bespoke training, targeted training towards the particular application or work area where the user is having. Support, end up spending, at least personally, a lot of time on Slack answering questions. And the employees or the users don't feel heard. Yes, they've told me that, and I try to get better. But it's. Turns out that it's just as much a problem for quantum software as for enterprise software. We're going to have a bit of back and forth now, digging through these and looking at some concrete examples. How many SDKs do we really need for quantum software? Every company in the field has their own. Every big research lab has their own, and quite possibly another. Literally everyone has a quantum SDK these days. And I get it. You write one, you can put out the press release, you can call your favorite marketing person, and you get the press release out, and you can say, hey, I built a new SDK. I've been there, done that. Great. But what's the value add? So referring back to also the original slides here, there's two great resources. There's this awesome quantum software repo on GitHub, which basically lists every single, well, not every single, but a big chunk of quantum software out there. It's super long. Most of them you never heard of. You can look at the Unitary Foundation survey as well, and you'll see that there's only a few that's really being used. So the value add of most of those are questionable, potentially including some of mine. But let's go back, take a step back to my first Ponto SDK. So I was running the startup Q&Co and we had a SDK because that's what you do. And it was built on top of Qiskit, let's say. This is all, you know, made up code, maybe even made to be worse than it really was, but, you know, illustrate the point. You basically just want to, I mean, you're a software startup, you want to have your key IP, you want to reuse it. And for us, looking just at the back end, for example, we ended up doing lots of derivatives because, you know, variational algorithms, good for startups. So you have some derivative calculation, some expectation value, just a run method, basically different ways of running quantum programs. This is all great. But then your engineering instincts kicking in, you figured, you know, that feels very, very amateurish. I should put an abstract base class in there. Because why not? And you probably want to have a local backend that executes locally an emulator. Maybe you want to have a remote backend. You know, you do some inheritance. Maybe even you have like a backend ABC class that, you know, provides the ABC for the backend, and then you implement it to have, you know, more code reuse. And, you know, you keep on going. You think, I should have a bit string backend, a wave function backend. Now, there's different types of result types that you can get in your quantum computation. And, you know, it makes total sense. You get to reuse some code. You know, you mostly have your application library somewhere else. It makes total sense. You know, you do some dynamic import lib magic to do all the imports via a string. Fantastic. But it can get worse. You can say, I have a partnership with IBM, and I have a partnership with Google. I have a partnership with Rigetti, who knows? There's a partnership with Pascal. And you end up having this for all the different providers as well. If you're not in the field, this might look completely arbitrary, but I can assure you this is real. It was getting out of hand, and it was getting difficult to onboard people on. Hard to extend, and also for our QML workloads, it was slow. But really, really the onboarding was a big issue here. When we started, we were like, I don't know, 5 people. But now Pascal is like over 300. So onboarding people in your software is a big concern. And I think that goes for the entire community. Figuring out how to make your software usable. So we tackled one thing first. That was better performance. So we wrote a numerical backend in Julia because JIT compilation and, you know, it's faster than Python, great. We bought 80 GPUs, so we had to use them, make them go fast, did the work. Now remember, there was a lot of inheritance back in the past. Inheritance and multiple languages JIT compilation it gets nasty. And then the Julia autodiff just didn't work well enough. It was too cumbersome to do the IR-generated autodiff initiation that Julia is doing. So we made it a PyTorch function, and we used the PyTorch autodiff engine. This ended up being very much of a bug, and we couldn't move anywhere. So we started from scratch, and it was all internal software, but started from scratch. That software ended up being released open source. We had we called it Cadence in the end, and multiple issues we'll tackle here. Another one was just that we were just tired of you know, doing circuit add X gate, circuit add Y gate, whatever, right? So we were like, we should have a different syntax. But like, syntax is fun. You can do something. We can publish a paper. We needed lots of parameters because type of workload we were doing. We had some special requirements there. Also, you see later, well, you saw also before in David's talk that registers are important to us because we're doing entanglement based on the topology of the chip, or, well, not chip, but atoms. Various needs for differentiation. Some of those are, you know, like backprop type machine learning differentiation. Also like PSR, like the way you do circuit differentiation and adjoint and all the good stuff. And this was a great idea. This is basically another form of the Hamiltonian that David was showing before. It basically shows how our device operates. You basically have, we use lasers to trap atoms inside a vacuum chamber, and we can manipulate them. And you can do that in the, X, Y, and Z direction. There's a lot of restrictions, let's not go into it. But this is basically what the program looks like. And in our main programming interface called Pulsar, we expose this AMO physics directly, and you end up having to talk about the amplitude and detuning, which are the omega and delta parameters in the Hamiltonian, specify the shape of it, phase zero, which kind of laser you're going to be operating on. This is requires a lot of knowledge. You need to be a physicist to understand that. And we thought, okay, let's make this more quantum information theoretic kind of approach, and more people can understand it. And this was great. This worked well, except so we could get like good buy-in from half the company. I was the half the company that worked with digital and moved towards analog, just to try to approach the hardware. From the half of the company that works on the starts from the hardware and moves upwards, there was no buy-in from this. This just didn't work out. And I think this is an important lesson. We only listen to, let's say, half the company when we design this. And for the half of the company that worked digital, there was value add because they can now run stuff on the device more naturally. But for the other one, they couldn't, and it was maybe less expressive. As a intermediate stage there, I have the slide of the GPU strikes back, how I spent the year of my life wasted on GPUs. The algorithms team said, we want more performance GPUs. We wrote two backends in PyTorch and Jax. Qubit count too low. We wrote a tensor network backend also in PyTorch. Turns out, in this case, a lot of day-to-day work of those people it's just too small to really have a speed up of the GPU, considering the cost of the GPU. And if you ever try to install CUDA, well, these days it works quite well, but there's a lot of issues there. So an important lesson for me there was just requirements gathering, and also maybe reaching out to all the people, because users will come with crazy requirements, and they will not, they may not need it. They hear the words, they see the papers of the groups, they want it. In the end, they may not use it. And I think as software engineers, it's our responsibility to push back on those kinds of requirements and try perhaps to adopt something else instead. Training is super important. I'm going to skip this slide. Basically, just the importance of documentation, of being there and speaking to people, I think is super important. And also, I'm going to talk about how I like to try to be very explicit when helping people. But I'm just going to skip this. Because I have a different, interesting story about two libraries that we wrote that also didn't. Well, and then there might be successful, but the first version was very clean, clean code, type code, dry, written for software engineers, but the algorithm researchers were never able to use it, because it turns out that when they do research, they always deviate slightly from what was known before. That is their job. They have a state of the art, they try to push it by some delta, and it's actually quite difficult to accommodate for that delta, like that slight push in new libraries. So we're trying now to go for more lean libraries in general. And just to promote our open source work, we're beginning to push out some things. Strategy not yet decided, ask David, the previous speaker. And another case of that was another library, which was only, it only became really popular after we started removing features. Because users are really smart, right? Our users are really smart. They usually have PhD in quantum algorithms. They know what they're doing. And we should try to let them be smart and not put engineering blocks in their way. Because maybe you think, I shouldn't allow this. But then maybe they have a valid reason to ignore, you know, what you think they should be allowed to do or not. Of course, that's a hard, it's hard to balance that against the what's actually feasible in hardware, but I think that's best left for review. Choosing your technologies is another topic. We had a great tensor network emulator that I loved it. Because I liked working Julia, because Julia is really nice to write if you're a software engineer and you know how to write code. Turns out to be a bit harder for the scientists who have a pure science background and not, you know, even computational physics background. And I also wasted a lot of time trying to deploy this at a customer site, the HPC Center, HPC Center. Because yeah, just Julia didn't have the required compilation to, you know, static .iso file. Yeah, then was the time when I built a convenience script to schedule arbitrary jobs in AWS Batch for our researchers because we thought they needed more compute, and I don't think anyone ever used that. Like, not even a single time I think someone tried to use that. I'm going to skip this story, but basically once I neglected some software running in the cloud for a year because no one used it, and then all of a sudden people started to submit like 10,000, 50,000 jobs in like a single batch, and it experienced a bit of bit rot there because it wasn't being used for a year basically, so it crashed and burnt and we got angry messages. Getting the timing right in quantum software is difficult because maybe what you think people need, they don't need today. Maybe they do it in the future. But if you don't get that timing right, that can be hard. I think that's going to be a big issue now that we move towards super NISQy hardware and people are starting to talk about fault tolerance. We'll be getting that timing right and choosing what to work on in order to hit the user's need. Quickly, some desires from open source people. I'd love more modular reusable blocks that don't depend on me using, say, Qiskit or your own open source framework. We had lots of bugs that I'm sure would have been easy to catch had we had like a SDK independent testing just test cases, basically. It's a repo full of NumPy vectors with some things. But I think we're getting there. I was at an interesting workshop on Friday with the European Commission, where they're going to focus a lot in the coming years on open source quantum software. And I think that's it. Thank you. Any questions?
So you mentioned in the beginning that there are a lot of software for SDKs for quantum computing, right? And you also mentioned that half of your company had adhered to your solution and another half didn't. The question is, have you considered using an open source SDK or even doing some proof of concept or even comparing if there is something out there that would solve your problem, right? And you could contribute back to the...
I have. We actually recently, he's asking if I've considered not writing my own software and trying to reuse other people's software and contribute back. Initially we followed the mantra of the industry, which is that a company should have its own SDK, and we did it just because of that. Press release, yay. We are now integrating more with other people. There was a big announcement in November between IBM and Pascal. We're working together on Qiskit, trying to develop a software stack aligned with each other. There's also, we're also partners today with NVIDIA, and they have a similar effort going on. As a company who sold devices to the EuroHPC and the European Commission, will be forced to participate in things there. It will be great. And also other places, but we're a hardware company, so we don't have really well-developed open hardware things yet. So that is still like a really big blocker for us. We need basically some SDK in the middle. But I like the idea, but it's...
Don't get me wrong, we are also developing our own
SDKs. Yeah. No, it was just a good way of getting the point back. Anyone else?
One of the things you mentioned is about designing software for researchers who want to push a little bit past what you design necessarily for. Do you have any tips for doing that in general?
Nope. I have no idea. I'm still working on it. If there's any, if I have any tips for how we can write software which is designed for letting researchers push past the limits, push past what we know so far. And, you know, honestly, still working on it. The best thing we tried so far was with this Cadence library, where we kind of removed a lot of verifications and restrictions that aren't really needed. It just makes you feel better. And we also redid one of our libraries that was built on top of Cadence with the same idea, removing basically any kind of check and just trusting the users to do it right. We had a big chunk of bugs to begin with, but by now they're really efficient with it, and I think they're much happier now that we've removed the bricks. But yeah, it also depends who you're designing for. We have, you know, we're 80, 90 people in Pascal Software now. Most of which are experts at quantum computing, and you might want to have them work without any breaks on, but it's really hard to get into it. So, work in progress. Anyone else?
On that note, have you considered creating a safe version of a program and an unsafe version then, so that like you can install the limits for the people who might need them and still have them?
Nope. If I were considered having the option to turn the brakes on and off. No, maybe slightly, but in reality, no. Maybe we could, but it's also really hard in Python. We usually work in Python. If you have maybe a compiled language, you can have this as a compiler, skippable compiler pass, but I think it's difficult in my current code base.
Regarding Rust and Rust typing, for example?
Regarding Rust, there are definitely people in Pascal who would like to move to Rust. But it will take some time to get there, at least. And, it also depends on which level you do Rust, right? You can do it at the operating system of the device. You can do it at the compiler itself. But then you still have the user interface on top, probably in Python, because that's what the workforce knows. And yeah, that's it for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.